KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Here's to Victoria, BC.
Pastors are fascinating, like even today. They have questions about how do we tell the best story? How do we tell this Jesus story in the new world we find ourselves in with passion and conviction in new and fresh ways?
The old transfer station is known for its dark decor and cramped confines where citizens and professionals work side by side, dumping trash into a pit.
I've really had great success lately with evergreen huckleberries. The ones that I've planted in as plugs just a few years ago have really made dramatic growth.
On KUOW this morning, we will be gardening in the 10 o'clock hour. We're also going to be talking to Rob Bell, Christian pastor, about keeping Jesus fresh. And we're talking about garbage. We're talking about garbage. Because, as you may have been tracking, Kittitas County, they're not thrilled to have our compostables. The plan was to send a whole bunch of compostables out there to be composted, but they were afraid of the smell. So yesterday, the Seattle City Council delayed a vote on the contract to send our compost to Kittitas County. Now, you may be wondering, where is it going now? Well, some of it goes up towards Everett, where it's composted. Citizens in Marysville don't like it too much either. They say it's smelly, though some folks say that might be the sewage treatment plant. Which raises the question for us. Maybe Seattle should figure out a way to compost our own waste in the city. Yeah, you'd want that, right? What's a garbage planner to do? Tim Kroll is Solid Waste Director for Seattle Public Utilities. Tim Kroll, good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Where does our compost, how much compost are we producing?
We're producing about 90 to 100,000 tons a year.
All right, that's a lot. That's a lot. How, you know, if you were to stack that up, what kind of stack would it make?
Oh, my. You know, the shipping containers or a semi-truck would be 25 tons, so say 4,000 of those.
Okay. All right. That's good. Now, where's some of those 4,000 shipping containers going right now? Up to Everett?
Well, we are our present provider is Cedar Grove. They have two locations, one North Everett, and the other, our stuff is also going out to Maple Valley, where, you know, there are similar problems in the community as there are up around Everett.
And the plan has been, well, maybe we can find a big canyon out near Kittitas County to do the composting in out there.
Well, we put out a solicitation for proposals from firms because the contracts we have are up in a year or two, so we have to go somewhere, and we put out that solicitation, and our existing provider did not propose, so that's out of the picture. And the two winning proposals were one corporation up by Stanwood, and the other one was by Elk Heights in Kittitas County.
Aren't you getting some pushback from the Stanwood neighbors too?
Nothing from them.
Not yet.
Yep.
Not yet.
That's an existing plant, so maybe they're used to it up there, and it's, you know, generally very well run. There's really not much of a history of complaints about that plant.
So how do people usually deal with compost in other municipalities?
Well, it's very similar to ours. It's put in windrows and aerated to keep it full of oxygen to reduce the smell. Generally, good housekeeping practices on the site. You keep use misters to keep the dust and odor down. Sometimes the piles or windrows, as they're called, are covered with a Gore-Tex fabric. Sometimes they're open. Stanwood up in Stanwood, their operation does not use the Gore-Tex, and it seems to work. But people have had a lot of success with the Gore-Tex as well. So there's a couple different ways of skinning the cat.
Is the technology getting better each year? Are people figuring out better and better ways to keep the smell down?
I think there's a developing body of knowledge about how to handle the airflow, and now the trend seems to be when the material first arrives on site and gets ground up, that seems to be in an enclosed building now. That didn't used to be the case. So there are, I would say, incremental improvements all the time.
Why doesn't Seattle try to deal with their compost in the city?
Well, we had an open proposal. We didn't say, hey, only if you're outside the city should you propose. So we're handling it like we had in a lot of other garbage contracts. We're putting it for open proposals, and you know, we got what we got. We got four proposals. None of them were in the city.
I guess I'm asking more of a philosophical question. I mean, is this something that, because it's waste generated by these citizens, should these citizens figure out a way to deal with it in the city?
Well, our compost has been sent out of the city for, you know, the 24 years that we've been collecting it, just similar to our garbage being sent out of the city since our transfer stations were built in the mid-60s. So we've been exporting garbage to Kent, then to the county, and now and then since 1990 to Oregon for close to 50 years. So, you know, it's when an urban area gets grown up, then there's less and less space, really. There's really not room for a landfill in the city, and it would be difficult to find space for a big composting operation in the city, too.
So when you guys look to the future, you garbage planners, there will be probably more demand on space and more people pushing back and more compost as more people theoretically adopt this way of dealing with their waste. What are some thoughts?
Yeah, so we're certainly looking to have increased diversion because that's what's really, the organics are really what's are driving our recycling rate right now. The citizens and the businesses have done a great job. We're at, in 2011, we were at a 55.4% recycling rate. There are technologies that are developing for one's called anaerobic digestion, and it's more, it doesn't take as much land as composting because it's all kept in a big, you know, they call it a vessel. It's a big tank. It's all kind of inside. It's more like a big factory than a kind of broad agricultural setup. And it's possible that in the future there may be one of those in the city. So that might reverse that trend where, you know, we're processing the stuff more intensively, and so therefore it could be done in the city, and then you take advantage of the savings and not having to haul it all the way out there. So, you know, that might be in our future. There was one firm that proposed that, and they were still quite a bit more expensive. So I think the technology is evolving, and maybe as energy prices continue to rise, because, you know, this anaerobic digestion does make energy, might pencil out next time around.
Right, that's what I was going to ask you, Tim Kroll. I mean, that's, you could have oil out of that, out of the anaerobic digestion. You could have gold.
Well, I don't know about gold, but the there certainly are increasing number of technologies that are trying to do something more intensive with the waste than just make compost out of it. Composting is usually part of it in the end, but first you try to get the methane out, and either to make fuel or to just burn to make electricity. And there are a number of those developments, especially in Europe, but increasingly so in the States.
But no pilot projects in our area?
The only anaerobic digesters in the area are very small scale that might work off of manure or other type of agricultural wastes.
You know, go ahead.
But Toronto has a big one and makes considerable energy and handles a considerable amount of their waste stream.
Do they somehow make that pencil out because they're avoiding shipping costs?
Yeah, I don't know the details of their analysis if they're paying a premium for that. And some people think paying a premium is a good idea because it's just a better use of the resource.
You know, just to deviate a little bit, when you look at what was happening up in the complaints about the smells in coming from different plants further north, is there a way of checking what the origination is of scents by some technological means?
Well, Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is right in the middle of pursuing a study along those lines. The state of the art is to have things called electronic noses, and, you know, they kind of are calibrated to the smell signature of different sources. And you combine that with some meteorological stations and have electronic noses at different locations, and then it's supposed to be able to cipher out, you know, where is this coming from, especially if it's, say, coming from the composting operation, what then you can determine what activity is going on that is maybe causing that that smell. There might be a couple different smells sources, say on a composting plant or another odor source. So, yeah, the city has contributed financially to that study, and that's going to get really underway this summer, which is kind of the odor season up there.
Tim Kroll is the solid waste director, directs the solid waste program for Seattle Public Utilities. All right, two last quick questions here. So the Seattle City Council delayed a vote on the contract. And I know this is, there's a political aspect to this, but from your point of view, what does that mean?
Well, I think we've been working with the council members now for a couple weeks. We've had two amendments to the ordinance to address some concerns, and I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to go in that direction. We'll be talking to the council members and seeing what their ideas are to address their concerns and see if those can be accommodated in a kind of revised approach. We're hopeful and optimistic that on Monday we'll get the green light to enter into our contracts. And, of course, you know, we'll want to make sure that there's good environmental care being taken no matter which sites we're looking at.
Secondly, you know, you guys just opened up, you're getting ready to open up, or is it already open up, the South Transfer Station?
It's taking the garbage trucks from our collectors, and we expect in the next couple weeks we'll be ready to start taking regular citizens.
When you look at that new South Transfer Station and all the money that was put into it, that it was a LEED certified facility, do you see a place for increased compostables in facilities like that?
That's not a facility where we're going to be processing there. It's still a transfer station where the stuff comes in and then it goes out, and it goes out in trucks in a more efficient way. And right now, our existing operation is only taking about half of the organics in the city, and the other half is going to a private station. The new station is so big that we'll be able to take all of that. So we have some cost savings there. But really, the end point of where it gets processed is not going to be at the transfer station, and that's the contract we're looking at right now with the city council.
And does the city have any plans to expand their worm bin and green cone program to reduce the waste at the other end?
Well, we always have that going on, and we've promoted that for now 2 decades, and a significant amount does go on there. But what we've seen as we've made the curbside composting more convenient, we've made it weekly, we've included other materials in it, that it's sort of, there's folks that say, you know, this is so easy, I'm just going to do that and not do it in my backyard anymore. So it's still a good amount of that going on, and we survey it, and we keep track of that, but it's probably less, and it's going to be hard to reinvigorate that when the curbside service is so easy. And we make the curbside service easy, so it's easy to keep it out of the garbage for folks. Not everybody has the inclination, the time to do backyard composting. And besides, we really recommend against doing meat and bones and things like that in the backyard. And those materials are accepted in the curbside program.
You're a victim of your success.
Well, it's one thing, grows at the expense of another one, but the overall numbers are going up.
Tim Kroll, I appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Tim Kroll directs the Solid Waste Program for Seattle Public Utilities. There was some pushback from residents around Clay Ellum to a contract that was proposed to send our compost to Kittitas County. There are two proposals. The other one goes up towards Stanwood. The Seattle City Council has delayed work on that contract for a week while they figure out what they can do. This is Weekday.
It's 9:19. Controversial Christian pastor Rob Bell on Faith and Politics in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center, a partnership with ProCure Treatment Centers. SCCA's new Proton Therapy Center allows doctors to precisely target cancerous tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at sccaprotontherapy.com.
50 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Clouds today, then clouds with a chance of showers tomorrow and Thursday, with sun returning for the weekend. So that's the weather outlook in a nutshell. We'll get a hike to match the week's weather a bit later this hour.
Keep you outside. Rob Bell is a controversial Christian evangelical. His support of gays, same-sex marriage, women's equality has put him at odds with the conservative wing of evangelicals. Some of his critics dismiss Bell since he is no longer accountable to any congregation. He was a very successful pastor at the Mars Hill Bible Church in Michigan. His success in telling the story of the gospel brought him attention from church leaders and put thousands of people into the converted shopping mall they used as a church. He stepped down last year to pursue other works, and maybe because he had moved away from the conservative tenets of his church. His books include Velvet Elvis and Love Wins, a book about heaven, hell, and the fate of every person who ever lived. He is working on a TV talk show with Carlton Kuse, executive producer of the popular TV series Lost. His newest book is What We Talk About When We Talk About God. In that book, he explores the way language, as he says, fails and also helps in talking about God. And he writes, when we do that together, talk about God, something happens that is divine. I asked him, why isn't that talking, that togetherness, that community, our humanity? Where's the divine?
When you talk about God, you end up in all sorts of weird territory in terms of language. The sense that there's more going on here, like my friend Rosa is Italian. She's a good cook, which is sort of redundant. I talk about in the book, she has these three-hour meals, and you're sitting there in about the third hour, and somebody will say, man, that was transcendent. Or we talk about our soul soaring. Or we talk about how, man, that experience, it took me higher. This intuitive human sense we have that something is what it is, and yet it points beyond itself. It's almost like it's an echo of a larger sound. Or when my first kid was born and I'm standing in the hospital holding that kid, if you'd say all that's going on here is you just biologically have been wired from thousands of years to care for this little pile of atoms and water, what is it about certain experiences that draw you beyond themselves to almost the vastness of the universe? And to just say, nope, this is all there is, there's nothing more. My experience has been for lots of people it doesn't work.
I'm not saying, oh, that's all there is. I'm saying, that's all there is. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Isn't that the remarkable?
Yeah. It's all miraculous.
Well, the difference between remarkable and miraculous, I guess. But I wasn't denigrating it by saying, oh, that's all there is. You stand before your kid and you go, whoa, look at
amazing.
Look at how, yeah.
Yeah.
I want you to take me to the next step. What makes that divine?
The sense that this is a gift. That it comes from somewhere, that you have in some senses, at the most fundamental essence of our being, we have received in some sense. We are the beneficiaries of a gift, and it moves us in ways that we can't explain, and we generally are most in tune with it when it's hanging in the balance, when it's fragile, when we may lose it. We're aware of this thing called life that is a gift.
You wrote something in this book, What We Talk About When We Talk About God, Rob Bell, about consciousness emerging when humans emerged. I'm paraphrasing now because I couldn't quite find it, but do you
recall? Oh, yeah. I was just talking about the increasing complexity and that you have these humans who come along at some point who start asking questions like, why are we here and what does it all mean? And this is a fascinating sort of development in the history of everything.
Is it an emergence? You did basically – I wish I had the exact quote.
Lots of people would say, yes, this is something that has emerged over time, growing complexity and consciousness and awareness and reflection upon, hey, we're here, and we don't have tails.
Like you said, the dinosaurs didn't do that. They didn't know they were dinosaurs. That's what you wrote.
From what we can tell, the dinosaurs weren't like, hey, you should read this book. It'll fill the hole in your heart.
So is that...
such a weird thing for a dinosaur to say, by the way.
Is that... You know what people also say, consciousness is just, you know, is not just, because I don't want to make it a just. Consciousness is the emergence of our brain getting more complex. That we created that. We are the creators of that consciousness.
Right. But what I find fascinating is we have unbelievably advanced, unprecedented new technologies that can do all sorts of unbelievable things like put thousands of songs in our pockets. And yet consciousness... let's be honest, it's more of a mystery than ever. I mean, we don't really have here's the deal. Next week, the Higgs boson will sort of fix that last little bit about why we have consciousness. It continues to be an unbelievable giant mystery that sort of sits in the middle of our existence.
Why does that take you towards God, you personally? Why does that take you to the question of, not the question of, but the works with God?
Because what's happened for me is being open to the more, being open to more going on here, it makes me a better person. To shut the door and simply say, this is all there is. We are just a relationship of complex biology. And when you die, the lights are turned off and the show is over. It robs life, to me, of the wonder and awe of being alive.
Rob Bell is our guest. So when I was talking to James Wellman, UW professor, who wrote a book about you, he was talking about, he said a couple things. One thing he said was that you were courageous, in part because you weren't afraid to be the absolute risk taker. So you left this successful congregation. Why you left it, we'll get to. And you moved to Hollywood. And you want to accomplish, and basically just kind of went on your own, it sounds like, but maybe I'm wrong. What do you want to accomplish by going to California?
In our culture, the two things, in my experience, that get people talking really quickly are religion and politics. You drop either of those at the Thanksgiving table and things get cooking, or you're sent to the kids' table. And when it comes to politics, we have a seemingly infinite variety of forums, everything from Rachel Maddow to Fox News to everything in between. But where is the place for discussions about faith and spirituality in sort of a broadcast space that's funny and intelligent and gratuitously inspiring and unexpected? And I think there's a giant space there that would be really, really interesting and compelling to create and then have that discussion.
Christian?
So, I'm a Christian, but no, a space for everybody, a welcoming space. Like, here's an example. I think an interview with Bill Maher would be fascinating. Why is Bill Maher year after year so committed to exposing hypocrisy and pursuing truth? I think that is he is a profoundly interesting person that year after year he keeps going after this and has obviously strong feelings about religion and God. And
I was going to say obviously strong feelings.
Yes.
The atheist.
But where is the fascinating discussion about where does this drive for truth and authenticity come from? I think it'd be a fascinating conversation without sort of generally, let's be honest, in the cultural discourse, the Christian's usually the one trying to convert or conquer. But what if the Christian was the one simply saying, I'm fascinated with you and what drives you and what were you taught growing up and what would you like to teach to your kids and what don't you and what repulses you and what inspires you? I think we ought to have that discussion.
Is that going to happen? Are you on the road to
creating
something like that?
So, we're progressing. My friend Carlton Cuse wrote and produced the show Lost. So he and I are doing the show together and it's coming along well. Yeah.
It's not like there aren't those messages. I mean, you mentioned Lost. Lost was a discussion about faith
exactly.
In the end.
Exactly. And he and I met up and we had written a show that we sold to ABC and I had said, actually, this is the other thing I really want to do. And our sort of friendship grew and he's like, okay, I'm in. Let's do this. So that's what we're working on.
You know, I was looking at some of so your sermons were on the YouTube for a long time.
The YouTube.
And there's an evolution in your thinking. Is that
mm-hmm.
fair to say?
Sure.
You went from more conservative to more, how would you characterize it?
Something else. Yeah, this is what's interesting to me. My understanding of the spiritual life, for lack of a better term, is that you grow. Like that you see things one way and then you have experiences that broaden you and deepen you and shape you. So it's fascinating to me how many interviews people are like, hey, you've grown.
Well, or you. But you just mentioned why. Institutions, faiths often don't.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that the organization that kind of exists to help people grow and become more loving and more courageous and less judgmental and more aware of the need to care for the environment. You know what I mean? All these sort of basic things about what it means to become a better person, that leaders of these institutions, when they grow, it's like news.
Well,
you know what I mean?
But you know why. Well,
I do know why. I just think that it's important to point out we're kind of flying upside down at this point.
Here's an example. You don't have a congregation at this point, right? You are
no.
on your own in the world. Would a congregation you opened up marry people of all genders? Are you open to gay marriage?
Yes.
So that's an evolution, right?
Yes.
I mean, you didn't used to believe that. Is that right? Or did you
always? The church that I came from in Grand Rapids did not.
No, but how about you? And you? Was that the evolution?
I came out of a tradition that would have not. But what happened for me is all of this, I started out as a pastor. So sort of whatever the sort of institutional rules are, for me, this was always about real people and real experiences. And why would I deny people that right?
I think another thing I heard in that this relates to that, you get two for one on this. The other thing I heard in one of your sermons was this was a sermon you were giving. Somebody said Gandhi's in hell. You were telling the story.
Oh, yeah.
The story was somebody said, an archer said Gandhi's in hell. And you questioned that notion that Mahatma Gandhi would be in hell.
Like crazy, yeah.
Well, because he wasn't Christian.
We did this art show, and I was doing a series on peacemaking, and somebody put up a piece of art. So people from the church were hanging art all around the building, and somebody put up this picture of Gandhi, and somebody added a note to the piece of art that says, reality check, he's in hell. It's like, how did the Jesus message, which is about God's love for everybody, lead someone to think, you know, I ought to put a note on this just to let everybody know for sure what's going on here? It's just crazy.
Do you have an answer to how that Jesus' message led to that?
Yeah, because a lot of people were taught we're right and everybody else is wrong. In the interest of God's love and God's grace, the whole thing got shrunk down to a particular tribal belief system that said we're in and everybody's out.
You must have people pulling their hair out when you tell Christians this. I mean, there is a faith, there is a doctrine, there's things we believe.
This is basic Christian faith from the very beginning. This is C.S. Lewis. This is Origin.
That's not the very beginning, but I get your point.
No, I was going back earlier. I mean, think about like the scriptures. You have these passages like Jesus speaks of the renewal of all things. The Apostle Paul speaks of the reconciliation of all things. Peter, the first, the caffeinated disciple, he speaks of the restoration of all. I'm glad you like that. The restoration of all things. I'm fascinated with how many really educated, important people, educated, intelligent, rational people aren't aware that the Bible has this expansive message about God's redeeming love and grace for all of creation. Like, this is what Jesus actually talked about again and again and again. So I'm not really making anything up. I'm just saying, hey, wait. Let's read the whole story.
I think, again, James Wellman, he wrote Rob Bell and A New American Christianity. He said in that book that you were talking about or maybe even offering a Christianity for a secular world, Christianity for a world that's not religious. What do you think about that notion?
Great. I think that who doesn't want to worry less or be less judgmental or have more of a spine?
Why am I worrying less if I'm...
Well, think about Jesus' basic teachings. Teaching how to, do not worry. He's teaching us how to live with peace and calm and how to be compassionate and how to love our enemies. My experience has been in the modern world, we want guidance in this. The modern world's kind of insane. It moves really fast and people say, I'm busy, as if it's normal. You know what I mean? Oh, I'm so busy. Oh, yeah, we're so busy. Oh, with the kids. Oh, we're so busy. It's kind of all crazy. What we really want is a deep, meaningful life with significant interactions with people that we love and help and people to walk with us through suffering. So these are, I don't know any modern person who doesn't want these sorts of things. And that's what the idea behind the Christian story is, that it would inform this and it would shape us into these kinds of people.
And you're good with me accepting all those things, but not being a Christian, being an atheist, being Hindu, Muslim?
I started out as a preacher, so my job is to tell the story. And I'll let people sort that out for themselves. My job is to tell the story well.
In this case, this story of the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I do. I try to keep really dialed in on that.
Rob Bell is author of What We Talk About When We Talk About God, author of a number of books, best-selling books. You're conscious of your market, right? You know who you're talking to and who you want to reach in the marketplace. I mean, it's a book in the marketplace.
Yes and no. With this book, I'm very interested in talking to all the people who have a sense of reverence humming in them, a sense that there's more going on here. And so the denial reduction thing doesn't work. This is all there is. And the traditional conceptions of God feel like Oldsmobile. You know what I mean? Like, that was for them, not me. So yeah, this book is for all those people who have some sense that there's more. But beyond that, when I do a book signing, if you could see who's in line, you'd be like, what? What demographic is this other than featherless biped? You know what I mean? There's just no rhyme or reason.
You could have gone a different direction because you were successful. You had 1,000 people in your church, and then you had how many by the end of the first year?
Oh my word.
10,000?
Exploded.
Yeah, exploded. You could have been one of those folks who was a social movement leader of a social movement, taking it one direction, but you went an individual route, I think. Is that accurate?
You know, I've always just tried to do the next thing in front of me. I have four books in my head right now, and I got to write them or I'll spontaneously combust like the drummer at Spinal Tap. You know, it didn't – I could mess up a one-car parade. I'm not your networking, marketing, hey, let's get – that's not how I'm wired. I make things and share them with people. So I actually quite quickly, when I was leading a giant church, realized that my affinity was more with artists who made things and shared them.
Like who, by the way? Who are you – who kind of – do you have some artists that you're particularly fond of that you're working with?
Friends who are musicians and sculptors and writers and friends who lead nonprofits and have like a – have a mission, and it's about communicating it and engaging people. So I have a broad range of friends who are doing all sorts of interesting things.
And the art you're doing is the art of communicating, the art of telling that story.
Well, I just realized there was a pastor impulse, like you're saying, which you lead. You're essentially like a CEO, and you have strategy and you have meetings. And I one time was in a meeting about meetings. They were like having a meeting to decide who should come to these meetings. And I was like, I'm in a meeting about meetings. So then I went to the guy who ran the meeting and I said, I swear I just spent an hour in a meeting about a meeting, at which point I realized I was having a meeting about a meeting about a meeting. And I was like, this is not the path for me.
We know about that. Jason and I, we know about that one. I can understand that. No, go ahead.
That's my problem is like this book, this new book is about, it quotes Jane Fonda, and there's a Taylor Swift joke, and there's a bunch of quantum physics. Like what? So I'd have stuff in my head, and you can't really say to people, I'd like to write a book about some Hebrew words, quantum physics, and quote Jane Fonda. People are like, what are you talking about? So I just would have to make it. So that's what happened is I would have ideas, and I just need to make this, and then we'll see what happens.
You know, you mentioned Bill Maher, Richard Dawkins as well, a couple of atheists. I mean, would you want it? You wouldn't want to have a debate with them, would you?
And I don't do well in debates, but I'm always interested. Frederick Buechner said it's always interesting why a person believes what they believe. My experience with lots of really great, kind atheists is they talk a lot about bad religion. So I'm always interested, where were you burned? What was the name of the church? Who was? It's fascinating to me how many people have intellectual positions because of relational heartbreak.
And historical heartbreak.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And the relational heartbreak is they go looking and realize they're not the first one, and all of a sudden you have great solidarity there. So I think it's fascinating why we believe what we believe and what we're going to pass on to our kids and what inspires us and what repulses us and what makes us angry and what fills us with hope.
I like the story you were telling about mountain climbers, hikers. You get to the top of the mountain, you work your way up, you think about how you're going to get to the top.
You get to the top
and you turn around and you start thinking about how you're going to get down.
It's an ancient midrash from the rabbis about Moses.
You need to be there.
Yeah, there's this really interesting thing in the Hebrew text about when you get up to the mountain, be on top of the mountain, which is sort of like, of course, when you get up to the mountain, you won't be anywhere else but on top of the mountain. So there's this fascinating sort of mystical commentary. Yes, it's because God knows that Moses will get to the top and immediately start thinking about how to get down, and he won't be fully present on top.
Well, is that something that's guiding you, that being fully present?
Yes, very much so.
Does it guide how you – it's clearly guiding how you're thinking about faith. How do you share that? Or is it necessary to share it?
Well, it's interesting. What I'm trying to do with the book is for many people, when you talk about God, it instantly goes to, do you believe the right things? What do I have to say, do, think, pray so that I avoid the coming wrath? I mean, that's really the thing that undergirds – that's the narrative that undergirds the whole thing.
Right. I'll be going to hell. You won't be.
Yeah. So let's just figure out who's right, who's wrong, who's in, who's out. But what Jesus talked about was seeing, which is very different. He uses a very different set of muscles. And one of the things I lay out in the book is simply the people who generally inspire us the most, who we want to be around, are the people who their presence, their very presence, it's like it slows us down. We find ourselves more aware of this moment. And the holy and the sacred are the terms I use in the book for this life. I mean, how many movies are about parents are really busy and they're missing the everyday moments with their kids. You know what I mean? How many arcs of movies, like the percentage would be fascinating to study. How many movies are about people rushing through life and something happens and there's some sort of incident and they are reminded to hold the people near them close?
And that message, is that the divine? What would you call that message?
Sure. Yeah. It's actually the ancient Hebrews had this word kavod, which I talk about in the book, this sense of weight. So it was a business term for, you know, weights and measures, but it took on sort of a figurative weight, like the sense that things matter. And we live in sort of a kavod-less world. We're like inundated with blips and squeaks and Kardashians and sort of stuff, you know what I mean, fragments that come at us, and it robs life of its depth and meaning. Sometimes when I'm speaking to a group, I will say, how many of you regularly feel like a number or like a cog in the machine? It's unbelievable how many people instantly start nodding. Like they're just pedaling on that wheel endlessly. And something within us tells us to slow down, that this matters. And if our eyes are open, we would see things that we know we're missing.
Rob Bell's latest book is What We Talk About When We Talk About God. Look for him on television.
Right? Or the YouTube, apparently, according to you.
Or the YouTube. Thank you.
KUOW's Steve Scherer talking with Pastor Rob Bell on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. The indigenous people of Seattle, the Duwamish tribe, will again be considered for federal recognition. Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott supports federal recognition of the Duwamish, and he'll tell us why in a minute.
Hi, I'm Ashley Ahern. KUOW's spring membership drive starts April 1st, and you know what gets the momentum going? You. With your pledge of $1,000 or more, you can inspire your fellow listeners to call and have their donations matched by your challenge. For details, email majorgifts@kuow.org or give us a call at 206-221-2732. Again, that's 206-221-2732. Thanks.
Some more numbers for you now. 50, that's how many degrees it is in Seattle, and 59 is today's predicted high. Sky is cloudy right now and expected to stay that way all day and overnight and tomorrow. Chance of rain tomorrow as well, with a high of 57.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Sounders FC. The Sounders FC have advanced to the semifinal round of the CONCACAF Champions League, where they'll renew their rivalry with Mexico's Santos Laguna Tuesday, April 2nd at CenturyLink Field. Ticket information is at soundersfc.com.
942. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act could mean thousands more Washingtonians will get health insurance provided by the federal government through Medicaid. But will that insurance translate into access to treatment? What are the issues that could affect access? We'll get into that in about 25 minutes.
The indigenous people of Seattle, the Duwamish tribe, have won another shot at federal recognition. This is Weekday on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scherer. On Friday, a district court judge vacated a denial of the tribe's petition for federal reorganization. They decided that they would let the tribe pursue that again. The story is kind of involved. It turns out that back in 2000, the Clinton administration thought that was a good idea, and they accepted the idea of recognition for the tribe. In January, an official at the Department of Interior approved the Duwamish petition in a handwritten ruling, but that wasn't signed until 3 days after that person had left office. And then the Bush administration came in and looked at the review, set it aside, looked at the approval, set it aside for some review, and then didn't get back to it until September of 2001. Probably other things got in their way. And then it was overturned. In 2002, a report by the Interior Department's Inspector General found the handling of the Duwamish petition, as well as five others, highly unusual. But they didn't press charges at the time. Now, though, the tribe, after having been fighting for recognition for many years, gets another shot at it. And Seattle Congressman Jim McDermott, who has been working with the tribe and has introduced bills calling for federal recognition of the Duwamish, will be back at it. Jim McDermott represents the 7th District in Seattle in Congress. Jim McDermott, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
So are you going to introduce legislation for the recognition of the Duwamish?
Are you kidding? Of course. God, this is the most exciting day on this issue in the 25 years I've been in Congress. We worked hard to get it done under Clinton, and then to have it snatched away by Bush's Interior Department was very, very disheartening to all of us. And the Republican Congress has since been unwilling to take it up. So the Justice Department has given us a new life. It's great.
What will it mean? How hard will it be to get it through? All right, so you'll introduce legislation. Will you have any opposition?
Well, I suspect there'll be some people. There have been people in the past who have not been particularly helpful in all this issue. But I think with the federal court coming in, it's going to be very hard for the Justice Department or for the Interior Department not to come up with the right solution again. I'm frankly not sure whether we need legislation as much as we need the department to make a judgment again.
Oh, I see.
I'm out of the country right now, and I heard the news that it happened, and so we'll, as soon as I get back into Washington, we'll figure out what's going on with the Justice Department and the Interior Department.
Well, you have had some people who have opposed it have been members of other tribes, but you also have in Sally Jewell somebody who one would assume is familiar with the issue.
I can't think of a better and to deal into than having Sally Jewell at the head of the Interior Department. She's familiar with Washington State. She knows that Chief Seattle was a Duwamish. And I think that this is a wrong, an injustice that has gone on so long that it really is infuriating. And I think that righting a wrong, whenever it's done, is important. And I think Sally will see the value of that.
What does it mean for the Duwamish if they gain federal recognition?
Well, primarily, it gives them the benefits of being a Native American tribe, a recognized Native American tribe. There is some, I think, money that comes with it, but it's other kinds of benefits in terms of health care and that sort of thing that they've been excluded from. The Indian Health Service doesn't recognize you if you're not a Native American in a tribe. And frankly, they've had a high level of things like tuberculosis and other diseases that have been untreated, and therefore their lifespan has been markedly reduced by the fact that they haven't had access to health care. So from my point of view, this strengthens their hand in getting good health care for Native Americans in the Duwamish tribe. And I think that's maybe I'm a little skewed, but I'd say that's the biggest benefit for them.
The Duwamish have a longhouse on the Duwamish. They have a presence. Will federal recognition increase that presence, increase their land holdings, anything like that?
Not in my understanding. I think they have what they have, and I don't expect them to expand the size of the land that's controlled by them. I mean, all these bands along the Puget Sound were small bands, and they had little areas, that's still true for the Duwamish. They don't have very much, but it's the recognition of a right that was given to them in 1850 at the Hat Tree Treaty, and they've been denied for a long time, and it's so wrong, and the healthcare issue makes it even more intense.
You know, the Duwamish started filing for recognition in this modern era in 1977. How long have you been active in helping them?
I came in 1988 to the Congress, so I've been, from 1989 onwards, I've been involved in dropping in bills and going and talking to chairmen and trying to, work some deal. And it's just been one of those things where there was not a critical mass until we got to Clinton. And the Clinton era Interior Department looked at a lot of these cases again with another eye. Others, they had been rejected before. And the Clinton era Interior Department came forward and said, hey, look, these people deserve it. And they granted it to them. As Clinton left office, he signed, or his people signed the recognition. And as Bush came in, the first thing his Interior Secretary did was take it away from him.
Well, as it's being reported now, the federal government, through a court, has vacated that denial of the tribe's petition for federal recognition and told the Interior Department to revisit the decision. Jim McDermott has been pursuing that effort for many years. All right, I got to ask you a question before I let you go. Two questions. One, what happened with gun control legislation in Congress?
Well, Steve, I was there. You know, when I came to Congress in 89, within 2 weeks they had that mass shooting in California where 5 kids were killed and 30 children were injured, all immigrant kids. And we started in 89 working on an assault weapon ban, and it took us 5 years to finally get something into law that had a 10-year sunset on it. And it went through till 2005, and there was no one who would bring the bill up on the Republican side, so it never was extended after 2005. So we're in that same thing. The people who came after us in 89 through 95 are still against banning any weapons at all, and they have held the field. And I never thought this thing was going to be easy when the president and others, you know, got out there and said, "Well, we're going to do this right away, and straight away we're going to have a change." Well, I guess I've lived too long to believe it was going to be easy. I think we're going to get something done, but how far we'll get down the road, I'm not sure.
What will you get done?
Well, I hope we can get background checks and everything. I hope that we can get something related to gun sales and, you know, these sort of street sales. I mean, Seattle had a buyback the other day, some weeks ago, months ago now, in which people were buying the guns from the people who were bringing to sell them back to the police. I mean, no background check or anything. It's just, it's flagrant passing guns around in the community, not knowing who in the world's buying them or whether they're capable of handling a gun or anything else. It was reckless. It was going on in the streets of Seattle the last few months. I hope we can stop that. The assault weapon ban, I don't know if we're going to be able to get that through. I don't know if we're going to get it through. I hope we can, but I'm not overly optimistic.
You call that reckless, but it was legal.
Yes. Yeah. This has been an area where Seattle had some gun legislation. I think it was Initiative 655, which was a trigger lock. And it would have been the toughest gun legislation in the world. The New York Times said we were going to pass it. And then suddenly the NRA came in and the 4-1 overselling it against it and defeated it. So there is a very strong opposition to any kind of gun legislation at all. And that's why the assault weapon, some people seem to think they need an assault weapon in their house. I can't imagine what they would do with it, but that's their belief that will make them safe. I don't think that's what makes you safe in a society.
All right, and finally, are you guys actually going to pass a budget, do you think? You guys being Congress.
Well, we're moving down the path of regular order much more than we have in the last 5 or 6 years. I think the Republicans have figured out that they ought to take their foot off the process and let the process work. And the House will pass a bill and the Senate will pass a bill. and ultimately we'll have a conference committee, and I suspect we're going to have a budget. I don't know if it'll happen by the end of this month. I mean, April Fool's Day is when it's supposed to. They said it was going to be out, but I don't know when it's going to get out. But I think we're going to get one this time.
And something you could vote for.
I didn't say that. It has a lot of, I mean, there's a budget has a whole bunch of things in it. And sometimes you have to decide, well, you have to take some bitter with the sweet. And I won't say I won't vote for it. I just say I haven't made up my mind. I want to look at it. I've been doing this too long to ever commit to voting for something before I look at it. That, to me, has always been reckless, and I wind up voting for stuff, and then somebody says, well, did you vote for this? Well, in fact, yeah, I did vote for it. It was buried in a piece of legislation. There were some things in the budget resolution we did on January 3rd that made it harder for us to implement the Affordable Care Act, and I was upset about that. I didn't vote on it. But I found out as time went along what had happened.
All right, sir. I appreciate taking the time.
Okay.
Take care. Jim McDermott is the 7th District Congress member from Washington State. He joined us to talk about the decision by a federal judge to overturn the denial for the Duwamish's petition to be recognized as a federal tribe, and they are now free to pursue that again with the Department of Interior. Michael Fagan brings us a weather forecast and a hike to get us through the week. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Steve.
It's good to talk to you again.
Same here.
Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather, LLC. You can find his weather forecast and his hike at hikewashington.net. How's the weather look?
Weather's looking very spring-like. We're looking at highs today, mid to upper 50s. Just a slight chance of a late shower, but dry day. Best chance of some light rain will be Wednesday and Thursday. Any rain is actually pretty limited. And then starting on Friday, we're looking at mostly sunny and 60. And then over the weekend, some forecast models are suggesting upper 60s by Sunday. So spring's here. So and with that in mind, we have a great hike, Oyster Dome, just south of Bellingham.
Oh, yeah.
This offers great views of the Olympic, Samish Bay, the San Juan Islands. It's kid and dog friendly. It's 6.5 miles round trip. And again, the best days for views will be Friday through the weekend. But again, even today, Wednesday and Thursday should be okay, but just some light showers. Another highlight, if you're really ambitious this summer, this is part of the Pacific Northwest Trail. It goes from the Washington coast to Glacier Park in Montana. 1,200 miles if you feel ambitious.
Are you going to do that?
No, thank you. I'm reserving it for you.
All right.
We'll put that on the back burner. But parts of it are certainly nice. There's some flowering currant plants that we can view on the hike. And if you're looking for a little bit extra credit hike, there's a Samish Bay overlook where you could check out the hang gliders, and that adds another mile and a half to the hike. And on the way back, check out some of the flowers. The Tulip Festival starts April 1st near LeConnor. So we got some pictures of some flowers on the website and some great views of Mount Baker. We don't have a Green Trails map for this particular hike, but we do have a hike posted on the website. So everything's there to enjoy.
That sounds great. Yeah, you got some nice pictures. That's a good hike. I know a lot of people have taken it. It's always fun. Michael, it's good talking to you again.
Same here. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week with weather and a hike from Michael Fagan. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Something you'd hear on the hike up Oyster Dome. That's the sound of a great gray owl attempting to call in a mate. Listener Paul sent us that sound as well as a video of the owl. We put that video up on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW, and also on the Twitter feed, KUOW Weekday. Check it out. It's a very cool video. He sounds a little forlorn there. I hope the mate shows up.
That is one relentless owl.
Yeah, it keeps going. What are you hearing? Record 30 seconds of your world and send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kuow.org. And stick around.
It's 9:59. As I'm sure you've heard, the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up same-sex marriage today and tomorrow. We'll get an update in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Selected Shorts, Funny Food Fictions, live on stage with Dennis O'Hare and Kirsten Vangsness at the Moore Theater April 13th.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.